Hello, I'm Teresa Ayers.
And I'm Janet Gallen.
We're the Love Letter Squad.
We are the Love Letter Squad, and we're here to bring you another program about just that, a story and a love letter. And I'm just going to go right to our guest. Today we have John Lesquois, who is, for those of you who are mystery readers and fans of his, will know him as the creator of Dismas Hardy. And would you like to say anything just to start out about your writing, or...
I'd like to know when you started and how you got into that.
Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. I started writing when I was very young. I was always the guy in my family that put together little plays and things for the kids to play with around words. And when I got to eighth grade, I had my first published piece in the Redwood City Tribune, which I think is no longer extant. But I kind of got the bug. I don't know why I felt this way. My father was an avid reader, I guess, but I'm the only one in my family that's gone in this direction, and it was a family of seven children.
But you said you went from writing one book, and then there was a point at which you really became the person you were, the writer you are.
Well,
what was that?
Yeah, I started, you know, trying to write novels in college. I wrote one in college, one right after college. Then I became a musician for several years. Then I started publishing books. And when I was 38 years old, 39 years old, I was failing, just completely failing. And even though people think that if you're being published, of course, that's not failure. But my vision was that I needed to make a living at it. So I decided to, well, I got sick. I got spinal meningitis, nearly died, was in a coma for 11 days, woke up and said, you know what, I'm going to give it a big shot.
Good
I'm going to write
you.
A different kind of book. And I took my character, Dismas Hardy, who had been a bartender and an ex-attorney in the first book that I had written about him, and I made him a lawyer, a practicing lawyer in San Francisco, brought him back to the law, and all of the things that brought him back to the law were themes within the book. And then finally I wrote a book called Hard Evidence, which sold overseas for a lot of money, even though here it didn't make it. But the book after that was The 13th Juror, and that became a big international bestseller.
That's great. Okay, it's nice to know. So, for us today, you had talked about... Well, talk a little bit about your family. You say you have seven... There's seven children.
Right.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up right here.
Redwood City?
No, in Belmont.
Oh, okay.
And I went a year here to USF, my sophomore year. I have an older sister, Patricia. I have two younger brothers, Michael and Emmett, and then three more girls down the line, Lorraine, Mary Jane, and Kathy.
And you were particularly close with the sister closest in age
well,
to you?
Well, you know, when I was younger, that was she was my... We were 11 months apart, Irish twins, as my parents called them.
Of course.
And, we were absolutely inseparable. We did a lot of the creative stuff together, which was really exciting for me because it was, kids are not always the most welcoming of creative ideas. And my sister Patricia always kind of got it.
Oh, I was going to ask you that. Is that because she was wired the same way, or just because
she
loved
really
you and wanted to?
Well, she seemed to be wired the same way. We did a lot of things. We wrote songs together, and we directed the. You know, if I was the writer of the play, she was the director of the play, and she could direct as an as an older first sibling. She had no problem becoming the director. And we were just really close all through high school, well into young adulthood.
And so where is she now, and what's her life like?
She lives in Redwood City. She still lives in Redwood City. She moved there when she got married, and she got married at 22, I think, or maybe 21. She's still there now. Right now she's traveling in Europe with her daughter, Amy. They're taking about a month to just travel together and have some fun over there. She's a mother of two. Her oldest son is David, and her husband is Joe.
So was that a nice thing growing up with seven children?
Well, it's all I knew.
Oh, I guess so.
Now when I get together with big family reunions, which we have quite frequently, it seems absolutely overwhelming. And, I have two kids of my own, and I thought two was plenty.
Well, I can see you've got a Harvard Dad t-shirt.
Harvard
so
Dad
I
t-shirt.
You had
yeah, my girl
somebody.
Just graduated from Harvard.
Nice.
And she's over in Barcelona right now. She's writing the Let's Go Barcelona book for the summer. And my son, I almost had my Cal cap with me, but I left it in the car. My son goes to Cal Berkeley.
Yeah. I think that sounds overwhelming to me.
Yeah.
And too much
And you mean having six brothers and sisters?
To having a family that big, and probably overwhelming for the firstborn.
Probably.
Who has to take care of and help out.
Well, we had the big guys and the little guys. That was clearly delineated.
Oh, there was a space?
No. It was just a random kind of breaking because Patricia, for example, was just too far away in years from number four, who's Emmett.
Yes.
Even though Michael and I and Emmett, being three guys, kind of formed a unit. But Emmett was the kind of the wall between the big kids and the little kids. The little kids were definitely the girls and sometimes Emmett. And the big kids were me, Mike, and Patricia, and sometimes Emmett.
Yeah.
We gave him the option when he was 11 to become one of the big kids.
Oh, how nice.
He
into
turned
the
it
club.
Down. He turned it down.
He liked being the big kid.
He said, I'm happy where I am. Thank you.
No, he was one of the little kids.
But he was the biggest of the little kids.
He was
the biggest of the little kids.
But we decided that we would, you know, he passed muster.
Yes.
And we would...
So was that hard for your parents? I sometimes wonder what that is like for a man to have... seven children to be responsible for and to have to work for and to take care of.
And he had
provide.
Nine. Two of them did not survive childhood.
Oh.
So I can't imagine, except that my father was a very religious man, and he really believed in, you know, the no birth control thing. And he thought that whatever God gave him, that was what he was going to do and be happy with it.
And he was.
Oh, he was extremely happy.
Oh, how nice. Okay, that's the
answer. He was not a frustrated guy, although he did, you know, he did talk about, you know, the, you know, men lead quiet lives of quiet desperation sometimes as we got older. So I'm sure there was a lot more going on in his brain than he let on to the kids. But to us, he was just the happiest guy in the world. And his motto, in fact, we had it hanging in the kitchen, was the greatest gift a man can give his children is the love of their mother.
Oh, yes. That certainly is nice.
Yeah. So he was a great guy.
Mm-hmm. And he's still with us?
No. He died at 65 back in 86.
And your mother?
She's gone as well.
Oh.
Well, I think about
smokers.
Her. Nine births. My
nine
smokers,
births and 9 million cigarettes.
Ouch. Yes.
Both of them
pretty
much
knew?
Died. Yeah.
Who knew?
So anyway, it was a, you know... it was a very interesting family to grow up in, and the seven was only the beginning of it because all of us had friends, and they were all welcome to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So quite frequently, we'd sit down to dinner with 14 or 15 people.
Ooh, I can't even imagine that.
I can't
even
really now, but we did it.
And are you close with all your siblings?
Closer with some than with others. I would say three of them right now are among my best friends, Mike, Emmett, and my little sister, Catherine.
Uh-huh.
Kathy was my wife's roommate in college.
Is that how you met?
Yeah, that's how I met my wife. So she's 11 years younger than me, and I know that's just awful. But, you know, I didn't meet her till I was 36. And by that time, she had met everybody else in the family. And so she kind of...
Now, you're saying that's awful because of the 11-year difference?
Yeah.
No,
It seemed like a big, you know...
I mean, that would have been awful
wedge.
If you had been 21.
Right. That would have been bad.
Right.
21 and 10 wouldn't have been as good as 34 and 23.
Well, you know, you see that now with women marrying men so much younger.
Mm-hmm.
And that works now because women are getting married at 40, and if they marry a 28-year-old, you still got a grown man.
I figure once you're over 28, you know, either one.
Oh, is that your
crowd? Well, let's just put that there. I'd say that's about the place you are, you know.
But when we were getting married, people, you know, girls were getting married at 20 and 21.
Right.
You couldn't date a 4-year-old. Right.
It's tough.
Has opened up the world, hasn't it?
It does. It does make a difference, though.
So your sister, you were talking at one point before about growing a little
Patricia?
More formal. Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, we were, as I said, just about inseparable. I mean, I actually took her on, this is kind of dorky, but I actually took her on dates when we were in high school. If she didn't have a date, you know, we'd go to teen club and you know... She didn't have a date, so I'd take her a couple times.
How nice.
Yeah.
To have a built-in
I mean, and she
escort.
Was a pretty young woman. I mean, it wasn't that she was, you know, impossible to date.
And you're no slouch.
Well, thank you. Anyway, we had fun together, you know, and it was just, it was kind of a great thing to do. But, you know, as she got, she got engaged to be married when she was 21 or something. She was going to be a nurse, and is a nurse, and has been a nurse. But... She got married and had a kid, and of course, even though I had six brothers and sisters, there's no way to know until you have kids what kids do to your life. and of course her son David is was like all children. He needed attention. And so Patricia kind of fell into being what I called cruelly a little boring. But she wasn't being boring. She was just doing something that I had no conception of.
Do you think she was bored? I mean, maybe she was boring to herself also.
Well, I think what happened was is that lives of quiet desperation thing that my father talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I think suddenly she went from being a newlywed and pretty happy and thinking about all the creative things that she was going to do with her life. And that more or less went away. She had another daughter just a couple of years later. She had Amy, who she's now, in Europe with, as I say. Mm-hmm. They're close and very good. But then she had two kids. And I think because of a lot of the stress of having two kids, her marriage was also troubled.
Uh-huh.
Now, she's still married today to the same guy, Joe, 40 years later or whatever
it is.
So it wasn't the end of the world. But from my perspective, as, her brother who was out traveling the world and singing in Europe and, still planning to become a famous author or a famous musician or at least...
What did you play? I meant to ask you that before.
I played guitar and sang and wrote my own songs. And I was just out there living the life. And... had long hair and was in the moment in the 60s or early 70s, and Patricia became a suburban housewife and a dissatisfied one at that. So am I allowed to go into details more about some of this?
Sure.
Anyway, one day I was living in Palo Alto at the time and singing with my band. And I was in my first marriage at the time. I was married for 2 years in my 20s. And I got a knock at the window in the middle of the night from my sister Patricia with her two kids, saying that she just was very unhappy and she was going to, change things. So so we brought her in. We talked all night. And she said, she asked me if I'd go and tell Joe, that, what was going on. They'd had a fight, obviously, and she had left the house. And so I went over at 6 o'clock, and I told Joe. And when Joe was cool about it, not happy about it, but he just said, please tell me when I can talk to her again or have her call me whenever she wants.
Oh, so he wasn't shutting the door on her?
No. I mean, he's a, good guy.
Yeah.
But he was also... from my perspective as a 28-year-old rock and roll wannabe, he's living a pretty staid life that I would not have found fulfilling. I mean, he was a seventh grade teacher of, computer and math, which was not what I was doing. And he was about my age almost exactly, and it was very hard for me to understand anybody wanting to do that or having two children. I just didn't have any understanding of anything, basically, in those days, which should have been a clue that I wasn't ready to start writing, but... Hello.
Oh, no, I thought that was just a clue that you're not ready to start getting married and have
children.
Well,
that too.
Okay.
Both of those were true. And, my writing was about as successful as my first marriage, which was not.
It was kind of a delusional time, wasn't it?
Well, when you're living, quote, the dream, much of your life is dreamlike. You're not looking for a reality-based foundation.
But it seemed
foundation.
Like reality, didn't it?
Of course it was. And I worked as a singer. I worked daily as a musician. And I was writing short stories that I liked anyway and trying to get novels,
those two groups had
together.
More trouble talking to each other then. I remember
It was like the Vietnam War thing.
Uh-huh.
When people came back from the war, this was back in 71, 72, 73. There was just the people who went, there was a continental divide them and those that did not go.
That's right.
And that's because there's just a worldview issue.
That's right.
And that's what happened with Patricia and I. So anyway, I did this, went over to Joe this morning and told him this news. And by, the time Patricia woke up at, 11 o'clock, she'd stayed up all night. So she took a nap and she woke up and realized that maybe she had been a little drastic and overblown. And she went back to Joe that day and I think felt like she needed an excuse to why I had come over and told Joe all the stuff, even though she had asked me to do it. And my parents were in town, so they, of course, heard early in the morning from her, you know. Anyway, it more or less came out that when I had been sitting up talking to her overnight, during the night, I had been the instigating factor in talking her into wanting a divorce.
Oh, my. Okay. So that's hard.
Well, that's my parents' thought. That's what Joe thought. That's what Pat, I think, told everybody, or at least left them with that impression. So I didn't talk to Pat for about 10 years.
And then you got back to
I said hello. Uh-huh. You know, but I was pretty hurt and betrayed.
I can see why.
So my parents came down to Los Angeles about 10 years later. And that's where I was living then, still pursuing the, quote, dream. And my mother, we were having dinner, and she said, have you talked to Pat and Patricia in years? I said, no, and I'm not going to. And she asked me if I would do it for her. So I did. I called her up, and, you know, and I don't think I said I was sorry, because I didn't feel like I had anything to be sorry about other than, you know, lack of understanding. But she... you know, was nice enough and was glad that I called her. And, you know, we got at least back to being able to talk. But then we had a kind of a second crisis. This is a bizarre thing, but about 10 years ago, I don't know what happened, but Patricia wrote me a letter about the fact that I had, you know, lost my faith, if you will. I'm not very religious to this day. And she is very almost born again, mm-hmm. not particularly Roman Catholic, but born again, mm-hmm. evangelical in many ways. And she wrote me this letter, you know, saying that I should come back to the fold and all this stuff. And I wrote her what I thought was a very nice letter, but I know that I can be a little brusque. So I passed it by my wife and my sister, Kathy, my little sister, both of whom got along fine with Pat. And I said... please check this over for, you know, lack of sensitivity.
How nice that you did that.
Well, I know who I am, and I tend to blow things when things go. I mean, I blow up. And but I'm aware of that, and, you know, that's half the solution to a problem, is if you're aware of it, maybe you're on your way to solving mm-hmm. it. So I wrote her this letter, and then I sent her the final draft of the mm-hmm. letter, not my first draft. Well, I got a letter back from her that said, now it's my turn. Because I explained my lack of belief and the steps that had come to it and blah, blah, blah. But evidently didn't like the way it was and you know, thought I was very conceited and mm-hmm. full of myself and all of these things. And, you know, I thought I was, you know, better, holier than now. And
So is this next letter yours to her?
Yeah, that was That's the letter she wrote back to me.
Right. I mean, today.
Well, then I didn't write. Oh, yeah. Now what we're doing here today maybe is the next letter. I mean, we have been, as I said to you when we were talking about this program, we have been formally, you know, punctiliously polite to one another and even nice to one another. I mean, I don't hate her. She doesn't hate me. But there is a vast chasm of misunderstanding.
So there's something to say.
Yeah.
Okay. So what in this love letter to her do you want to say? Let me ask you this, what we ask people in workshop, and what's your goal for this letter?
You know, I just had a niece die last Friday, very recently.
That's awful.
And, you know, that's one of the things that brings to mind the importance of family.
Yes.
And the importance of keeping close to people who are close to you, not just family.
So you had somebody leave permanently
through
nobody's control, and why lose somebody when it can be avoided?
Right.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and there are still cultural differences that I think are pretty much irresolvable between Patricia and myself.
So given that, what is it you want her to know that you are thinking? Or
basically,
that you feel?
I want her to know that I love her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it's hard to talk about the things that are the sources of our differences.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the thing I'd like to overcome. We don't have to talk and have an argument about things we disagree about.
Mm-hmm.
We can just agree to not agree.
Mm-hmm.
And that should not necessarily stand in the way of, you know, our relationship.
So I'm just, in terms of a love letter,
mm-hmm.
To say that you don't have to talk about, argue about differences, and those shouldn't stand in the way, and for mm-hmm. sure they shouldn't, I agree.
Yeah.
What is it you might want to tell her about what you do love about her?
Well,
and kind of reinforce those things.
You know, I recognize that, number one, she's a great parent.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a huge thing that I had no concept of before I had my own children. She's a very good aunt to my children. You know, she's been a very loyal wife.
Mm-hmm.
In a relationship that I don't think was as romantic as I would have preferred it to be. And I always opted for that romantic option. Mm-hmm. That's just who I am.
You have that in your life?
I do, yes.
Nice.
Going on 25 years pretty soon. So those things are paramount, really, in what a person is. You know, there's also been issues with money, with having more, not a fixed income, but an income that is commensurate with being a school teacher and a nurse, whereas I've had a little bit of success in the book business, and I feel like I'm kind of a wild, free spender, and Pat has had to be... a little bit more conservative.
So can you say that in some way?
See, I need somebody to edit these letters.
Yes. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is I respect your fiscal responsibility.
Yes, I do. That's a good way to put it.
And without even mentioning...
No, you don't have to mention
comparing
it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, what she's been able to do with her, family and her income and her... lifestyle, you know, is certainly absolutely commendable.
Mm-hmm. And
she's also, I have to say, a fantastic friend to my little sister Catherine, my other little sister Mary Jane. You know, she is the bond. She's the bond that has held the women in the family together.
Oh, that's a nice thing.
How does she do that?
She's just always there for them. She, Kathy, my little sister, looks on her as actually almost her mother.
Mm-hmm.
She really did a terrific job of being Kathy's good friend,
mm-hmm.
and
so
counseling
she listens,
her.
Listens.
Oh,
and
she's yeah. They, in fact, they're very close. They haven't had the tumultuous relationship mm-hmm. that you know, I've had with Patricia.
Mm-hmm. So, and I'm curious about something else because I know it can be such a negative, but I sometimes think it hides something well-meaning and even loving.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think her wanting you to come back to the fold means?
Well, you know, I think that goes way back to our roots in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I think she wants to feel like we're all kind of the same.
Uh-huh.
We're all from the same family. We're all from the same background. And to some degree, a lot of us in my family are mm-hmm. still living that same general lifestyle. I don't know, lifestyle. That general cultural life.
Mm-hmm.
Which I found boring back in my early 20s and don't find very exciting even today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my fault. But it's something I just can't get over.
I mean, you said it's your fault. That's you. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just the nature of my life has led me to do to be around a lot of creative people, a lot mm-hmm. of artists, a lot of people who are really trying to make a difference in a kind of a macro way where mm-hmm. I think Patricia's...
Would she want to know that whether or not you're religious, you're still the same family? Or is that something better not even discussed?
Well, I think she knows that. I mean, I feel like I am a very spiritual person. You know, I feel like we have raised our children in the same manner.
Mm-hmm.
We're all of the kids in the family are trying to do good.
Yes.
we're all working hard. None of us are slugs.
Okay.
All seven of us, you know, are doing okay.
Okay.
But
I think that's a nice letter.
Yeah, I think she just needs to know that, you know, she is the big kid, and it's okay.
But the other thing about a letter,
yeah.
You say she knows these things. A letter, when you're feeling doubtful, you can bring it up and read it again. And mm-hmm. I forget who the woman is who said you can't reread a phone call.
Right. Right.
This is forever for her.
Good. Well,
all
I think
right.
it's a good thing.
I do too.
Yeah.
I just wonder if bringing up the spiritual part would seem a bit argumentative in a letter.
Well, that's the problem I always have, is mm-hmm. I'm always trying to kind of... It's funny because I don't really feel the need of it in my normal life, but with Patricia and, you know, a few other older friends who knew me when I was young, I tend to want to explain mm-hmm. why I feel this way.
But what if you don't explain? What if you just say something like whether or not we hold the same religious views,
uh-huh.
we are family, and I'm still your Irish twin.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
That's what I mean to say.
That's what you mean to say.
Yeah, see, I needed
okay.
to run it by you guys,
and
too.
All seven of us are doing well.
Yeah.
Love.
Your brother.
Okay. So I'm just going to give you these notes.
Okay.
And I hope you'll... Well, you're a writer. You can't help but doing it, right? So you'll send it to her, and if we never send a love letter to get anything in return, because it's a gift. I mean, this is a
sure.
gift from you to her.
Right.
But if anything interesting happens that we can share with our listeners...
I'll let you know.
Would you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
This is lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
Good.
You for doing this. I think this is going to be just really helpful to anyone who hears this who is in a similar circumstance.
Good.
And family's family. People are.
I was just going to ask about the signature... Does she call you John, or did you have a childhood name that you'd like to...
No,
find?
She calls me John.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was Johnny and she was Patsy, but she's become Patricia,
uh-huh.
and I'm certainly John, so
okay.
we'll leave it at that, I think.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank
yes,
you.
Thanks so much. We want to thank all of our listeners as well for joining us, and hope you'll join us every week at this time. If you like, you can also go to our website and read more about love letters. That's loveLetterSquad.com, and Janet loves to spell it.
I do. It's LoveLetterSquad.com. And if you Google John LaCroix, you can get his website. We'll have it on our website as soon as his show is on
mm-hmm.
also.
Okay.
So please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter is a special occasion.
And we encourage you to put those loving thoughts into words and send them while you still have the chance.
Yes, we do.
So till next time, again, thank you, John.
Thank you.
And for next time from Janet and me,
bye.